Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Sat on a tree, down a down, hey, down a down. They were as black as they might be with a down. One of them said to his mate, where shall we our breakfast take? With a down, derry, 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 down, down.
Hello and welcome to a bonus episode of the Three Ravens podcast. We're on a break at the moment, researching and writing our fourth series, but to fill the gap, this is the first of three new compilation episodes containing a trio of stories from across our earlier series. We've entitled this episode Three Marsh Tales because, perhaps unsurprisingly, it contains three stories set in misty, slippery, squishy bogs, including our Cambridgeshire story, Hereward the Wake, our Huntingdonshire story, The Lantern Men, and our Lincolnshire story, The Tiddyman of Ancombe Vale. If you're interested in supporting the podcast and would like to access all of our episodes ad-free, as well as tons of additional content like monthly exclusive episodes, episodes of the Three Ravens Film Club, our newsletters, stories as text versions, and more, do consider signing up to our Patreon at patreon.com/threeravenspodcast. In fact, on Thursday, we have our brand new exclusive episode for March coming out. So if you're desperate for a brand new Three Ravens goodness hot from the oven, that's where to find it. Otherwise, for our archive of all past episodes and expanded information for each episode, as well as our shop full of Three Ravens merch, please visit our website at threeravenspodcast.com. We'll speak to you soon. And in the meantime, we'll start spinning our yarns. Right after this.
Listen to that rain. You know, there was once an English man who could hide inside the rainfall. I met him in Flanders, fighting in Scaldimariland. A mercenary. He was paid in gold by Robert of Frisian, and that is where we became friends. Even then, he was a legend. His mother, the naked horse rider, Godiva, was known in all towns, all cities. His father, Leofric of Mercia, Elderman of the Hwicca, was a Northman, like me. But his son, Hereward, was not like Leofric, Hammer of Harthacnut, obedient against Godwin of Wessex. He was not like Godiva, the holy wife. He was a moon son, blessed by the Vanir, with blood like boiling rage. Hereward was a younger son. His brother, Alfgir, was his father's golden son. Hereward was not a son of gold or silver. He was a son of iron. A child of rage, always fighting, always hiding. Hereward was banished in his 18th winter to the outer kingdoms of England. It was then in Fife, fighting for Domnall Mac Doncada, when he was dueled with a bear, mighty and fierce, in unarmed combat. Hereward, bear strong, emerged victor. It was then in Cornwall, when he stole the Princess Turfida from the castle of Condor. Later, when a tournament fighter in Cambrai, he married Turfida, but fathered no sons. His life, bathed in blood, saw Turfida flee from him. She took to a convent, where she gave herself to God instead. Heartbroken, Hereward went to war for Robert the Frisian. There, I, Morten Lightfoot, became sword brother to Hereward. By night, we walked long shadows, danced with our blades, and hid in the woods like owls. We were like the goat's eyes, seeing, plotting, fading to the trees like the waves into the sea. It was then Hereward learned of the death of Elfgar. William the Bastard had invaded England. His men had murdered Elfgar, heir to the lands of Leofric, and placed his head onto a pike in front of his own castle key. With our blood-stained gold, gifted on the death of Baldwin of Flanders, Hereward and I sailed for England. There we found the new lords, feasting in the halls of Leofric, feasting in the halls of Alfgar. We passed through the gates like the night storm. 15 Norman knights were in the banqueting hall, laughing, eating, mocking the name of Godiva as a whore. All fell beneath our blades, and from that place of slaughter, riding stolen horses, we went from house to house and raised the allies of the House of Mercia. Our men, our brothers, fled with us to Meadshamstead, and there, above the ancient Hedda stone laid by King Paida, son of Penda, Hereward was knighted by the Abbot Brand, his uncle, and so he was declared protector of those lands. In those times, the men of William the Bastard rode through Mercia, carving the land into new countries. With such numbers, we could not fight head to head, so we fled back to Flanders. But the reach of the Bastard was long. First, his ally, William the Warren, sent his brother Frederick to kill Hereward. He came to us with an army, but Hereward outwitted him and sent Frederick's body back to the Warren as an offering of peace. So it was that William the Warren came himself, challenging Hereward to battle. On horseback, William the Warren rode to Hereward, who, on foot, took down his bow and notched an arrow and slew the Warren with a single shot. For strength, Hereward travelled to Soderup and to the mead hall of Svein Estridsson, king of the Danes. I think you never met him. He had so many sons. but I knew him well. Old enemy of Harald Godwin's son and wily grandson of Swain Forkbeard. Estridson was no ally of William the Bastard. From the port of Abendra, we sailed north for the holy Isle of Ely in the Mercian kingdom of the Gyros. Here, the holy treasures of the monks were taken by Edstridson to Denmark for safekeeping, and the campaign of Hereward began. The abbot Brand at Meadshamstead, uncle to Hereward, had been killed by William's men. In place of the ancient church, the Norman men had built a new abbey, Peterborough, and put in Brand's place a new archbishop. His blood was spilled by Hereward in that place of stone, the cathedral sacked, and all the treasure gifted to Estridson for his protection. These days were days of slaughter and war, but the rising pillars of smoke were as a signal fire, calling allies to our banner. One such ally, Morcar, cousin of Hereward and ousted Earl of Northumbria, escaped from London and joined with us. Then, from the Isle of Ely, deep in the Fenlands, we sheltered with the Bishop Athelwine and planned the battles to come. In one long winter, William the Bastard sent to us two foes who were much afeard. The first, Belsar, the great siege planner, came with masons, woodcutters, and chests of gold. The second, the witch Sicelgaita, spinner of whispers, came with servants of the dark. Together, Belsar and Sicelgaita surrounded our holy isle, lighting night fires and sending blackest, whistling terrors sliding through the still waters of the bogs. We could not hide from these dark powers, and so Hereward and I slipped from Ely and battled the demons in the dark. Creatures without blood or bone, our blades cut through them as scythes through summer wheat, their forms falling into the fen waters as clay. Hundreds such demons we slew, hunting always for Sicelgaita, whose craft was as sharp as ice. But Hereward, the watcher in the dark, had blood on his teeth. He would never surrender, and like snow melting in winter, he found out Sicelgaita hiding in a tower in the marsh. Here he burned her, and her demons and her night whispers could not save her then. Alas for Morcar, who was weak. Belsar, from his fortress, tempted Morcar with gold. First, Belsar bribed the monks of Ely to show him the way to the island. The Normans built a causeway from timber a mile long. But the knights, in their armor, riding their horses, sank the ramp into the waters there, and the invasion failed. But Morcar went to Belsar seeking peace. Instead, Morcar was imprisoned. And so Hereward and I fled from the Holy Isle, never to return. For years we hid amongst the bulrushes there, living in the stink of the mire. But Hereward was never one to face battle head on. We were raiders, our allies in the towns and villages, knowing Hereward in disguise. Dressed as a potter, selling wares, he came to them with word of his resistances. They made gifts to him of food and blades and fresh arrows, knowing he would fight for them until his dying day. Yet William would never give up. No longer William the Bastard. He then became William Conqueror, King of England. Outer Mercia was no more, replaced by new shires. Bedford, Huntingdon, Northampton, Cambridge. And to these lands the conqueror sent a giant, Ogor the Breton. For it was known in these days that Hereward was once again in love. Alftruda, widow of Gospatric, was beloved of Hereward, and the two made to have a wedding day at the Abbey of Thornay on the Fenland's edge. Only on that day, when Hereward and Alftruda were joined by God, Ogor the Breton arrived with an army marched from Crowland to the north. And so, instead of a bear, Hereward dueled with Ogor beneath the summer sun. And as they fought, the clouds covering the sky, rain began to fall and lightning forked above them, for the Vanir were watching. Steel clashed steel and the earth moved below them. But Hereward was older now, with silver in his beard and the marshland waters in his bones. Ogor the Breton defeated Hereward, and the hero of the marshes was bound in chains. His bones were broken, one eye was lost, and Alftruda, the new bride, was imprisoned with her husband, and the march to London began. But Ogor, for all his might, had little wisdom. He took Hereward and Alftruda south to the edge of the marshes, and that is where we found them out. The battle was one of ugliness. Ogor slew many of our men, and though we struck back with twice the fury, their numbers were too great. Yet, I did not fight that day. Instead, as the rain fell, I stepped through the drops and loosed the chains on Hereward's broken form. So the hero made one last escape, he and Alftruda vanishing for a final time. His forces decimated, the resistance was over, the conqueror had won. It is said Hereward and Alftruda took shelter in the court of Domnall Mac Donchada, his old ally. I will never know, and if I did, I would never tell. For I, Morten Lightfoot, have come home. As you know, Harald Whetstone, iron cannot contain me. Stone cannot stop me. Wood is my friend. The knife I have at your throat is an old blade, but it is sharp. And so, I am sorry to disturb you in your sleep and to come here in the dead of night, but I seek the treasure your father took into his safe keeping. The relics of Ely and of the Meadsham Stead are no doubt in your treasure vault even now. What a shame for such brightness to be gathering dust. Perhaps then you and I can take a walk to see them. If you don't scream, it will be simpler. We both know there are many more brothers to replace you on the throne. And if all goes well, you may yet rule a long time while those relics and I will vanish from here, like owls into the night.
Have you ever walked across the fens at night? If it weren't so dark, you'd see for miles and miles, for the land is as flat as a disappointed lover. It was made flat, you see, so that you could never hide. Someone will always see what you're doing. You're never alone in the fens, for we are here. You might have seen our dancing lights hovering above the black stagnant water. Her reflections make him seem near, then far away. The darkness and the stench of the marsh gas will so disorientate you that you won't know whether the lights are before or behind you until it's too late. Some call us Boggart, some Willow the Wisp, some simply the Lantern Men. There are other things here too. The nightshades, the slithering dark eels, the dead hands which thrust from the water and grab, grab, grab. But we are the oldest. We've been here since this twisted mess of a world was made and then discarded. And we've had a powerful hunger ever since. We all have different methods. But I like the old way, the simple way. Use my lantern to guide the lonely traveller into a treacherous patch till they stick fast in the mud and it pulls them down, 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 drowning them slowly. The black foulness of swamp mud forcing its way into their noses and throats. And then I consume them. Savouring every last delicious moment of horror and regret. We do not haunt the fens, we are the fens. We are the damp, rich scent of the place, the mists escaping the mirrors. Night after night I seek flesh and bone through the reeds and sedge. We are the darkest of the dark. Except for the warm, almost comforting glow of our bright lanterns. You'd never see one of us, even if you came close enough. We caught the moon once, and we would have kept her too if we hadn't been tricked. How we laughed when we trapped her in a mirror and plunged her down under the water, slapping wet mud over her bright, shiny hair. I danced myself on the heavy stone we used to weigh her down. She got away from us, and now she shines as bright as she can over these fens to take her revenge on us and keep wanderers safe. Our prey are always trying to trick us. They know no other defence, so they seek to outwit us with cunning. They have their little ways, things they do, thinking to protect themselves from us. Whistling is one. If two are travelling together, they split apart a little way, leaving a wide enough gap between them that it seems as though they aren't together at all. Then one will whistle, drawing the lantern man in his direction. But just as our bobbing lights get close, the other whistles, drawing us away and back to him, and so on until they've reached safe ground. Of course, we're wise to that now. Our lanterns have shutters, and we can split up too. Even more pathetic is the way they clutch their little safekeep bags, which are supposed to scare us away. Packed with sad relics, eel slime, bits of dismembered wood creature. What's that supposed to do other than add a little sauce to the dish? And they think that lying face down on the ground, mouth in the mud to stifle any noise, will see us off too. If I come across someone lying in the mud, I don't go in the opposite direction. I close in and enjoy the splendid meal laid out before me. Oh yes, we know all the tricks. Aside from the moon, there's only one man who ever got away from me. The lying down trick did work for him, for he kept so silent that I passed by without either seeing or hearing him. I didn't have an inkling there was anyone there but me, till I'd gone some distance past him. Well, he scampered back to his farm, and I wasn't quick enough to catch him. His farm was at the edge of the marshes, you see, and I saw there was a horn tied to a pole outside. Was that supposed to scare me away? Or the birds? Either way, it was ridiculous, and I burned it to scorched black scraps with my light, so he'd see it and know to stay off the marsh. I won't be deprived of my dinner twice. Usually it's very easy, like the one I've just eaten. He thought to bring a dog to protect him, as if a dog would do anything against the Phantom of the Marshes. Stupid creatures. Tasty, though, if you don't mind the hair sticking in your teeth. Of course it raced away from him, and of course he whistled for it to come back. He whistled, I answered. Man and dog I took pleasure in drowning, and man and dog I ate in wet gobbets and sucked the marrow of their bones. Another missing person lost to the marshes, lost to the misty delirium of this place. I please myself, you see, toying with life as I like. Humanity doesn't like to play with its food, but we lantern men are bound by no such rules. Food tastes all the sweeter once it's muddled and mixed up and turned all around. Sometimes, once in a while, when that cursed moon is sleeping and our sky is as dark as our ground mists, I'll choose to let one go. But only sometimes, if my hunger is already sated. And sometimes, what happens next is sweeter. I'll tell you a tale of one, if you'll follow my light just a little way. It was a night much like this one. The moon was playing coy, just a sliver of her peeping out from behind a cloud. "Show yourself again," I urged her. "Come down here and show yourself in all your shininess, and I'll have you this time, and I'll bury you where nobody will ever find you." I heard them before I saw them, footsteps sloshing thick in the marsh mud. A young couple exchanging words. His voice was brusque and rough, and he answered her questions abruptly, as if he would cut off her speech. Hers was hopeful, piping, chattering to him about all manner of things. When they hove into my view, she was clinging to his arm, worried about the dark. He was a huge brute of a man, and she a tiny little fairy with an ugly face. She was twittering to him about starting a new life together somewhere, and he told her that they would. I could hear the lie in his voice, smell it in his sweat. Something I like about humans. They trick each other the way they like to trick the lantern men, and so his lying words caught my interest. I like my food to have a little spice, after all. So I delayed flicking open the dark panel of my lantern, though my long, shriveled fingers were itching for it. My hand doesn't look like yours, as I live in the dank marsh water. We're always wet, and our skin wrinkles and bloats like the flesh of the drowned. She told him that she was scared of the dark, and he told her he would look after her, and something in the way he said it let me know that he did not mean it. And so I waited, for I wanted to see how it would all play out. He suggested they sit down and rest, and he gave her some bread from his pack. Good, soft, white bread which shone palely against the dark night. She took it gratefully and seated herself carefully on the verge despite the darkness, as though they were having a lovely picnic. He stayed standing, and when her mouth was stuffed full of that fluffy white bread and she wasn't twittering anymore, he grunted out, "Now I will be the death of you." Oh, it sweet to watch as he choked her with his fingers and thumbs. And when he was finished and she lay still, he untied her garter from her leg and tied it tight around her neck just to be sure. The half-chewed bread spilled from her blue-tinged lips, and her eyes started out as though somebody had pinched her. Now, I was enjoying this so very much, and thinking how good they both would taste, so full and rich in fear and sin and murder, when I heard a little sound in the reeds, not far from me, a tiny noise, like a gasp, and I had almost missed it. A girl, yellow hair, bright and sweet, must have been making her way across the marshes too. She had a little light of her own, which was foolish as anything. As soon as one of my kin saw that, she'd be doomed. She was just the sort I liked to eat too. But I paused for a moment. She was crouching down, hiding, and looking at the man dragging the body of his girl into the reed beds. And I thought, there's more trouble to be had here than I can cause. You see, we like trouble, we lantern men, we like chaos, we like the swirling of thunderclouds and the ringing of alarm bells and the screams and swoons of the fearful pointing fingers of accusation, the slam windows, and we'll cause it any way we can, even at our own expense. I could see that she would go and inform on him. I could smell the goodness in her, shining brighter than the weak light of her little lantern. Sure enough, when the murderer had dumped his girl's body and made his way off through the marsh, she gave herself a shake and she said a prayer. Well, I stuck my fingers into the sticky grey wax in my ears when she did that, for I hate the words of prayers and the sounds of hymns more than I hate the moon. And she said to herself out loud, right there in the marshes, with no regard for who might be listening, "Susanna Bird, you do the right thing now by that poor girl." And I knew she meant to get that man caught. But it was with great regret I let her go. For a girl like that, the yellow hair, great handfuls of it like that damn moon, it's just the kind I like to drag into my pool and devour. But sometimes there's more fun to be had when you leave things be. And I haven't got to the age I have without learning that a long existence craves variety. I was not disappointed when I made my way along the waterways at night, following the scent of the yellow-haired girl to find out the result of my selfless act. All the way to the waters of Granter I went, through the roaming ground of the nightshuck, and to Cambridge, where his trial was being heard. I wasn't in the court, of course, but I heard enough of the gossip from lurking under the town's many bridges, and from my kin who cluster there, flocking like carrion birds to death and tragedy. His name was Thomas Weems, my murderer, and the girl he'd strangled was his wife, Mary Ann. A naughty boy had a second wife he liked better, who didn't have an ugly face, and he wanted to get rid of the first. And she tricked him too. She was no angel, make no mistake. Making a play for him when she'd been just a girl, and telling him her womb was swollen with a baby when it wasn't. Humans are so delicious. Susanna Bird, all glowing with the light of righteousness, testified about what she'd seen in the marshes that night. I could have done too, of course. But nobody asked me. It all came out in the trial and the questioning, and Thomas Weems was sentenced to death. And oh, the things they did to him. It was beyond even my imagining. Acid and electricity and steel plates, 1,000 jolts and volts. What a flavour his corpse would have if I could get my hands on it now. What's left of it, of course, for it was dismembered in a public gallery for anyone who cared to watch. I heard from listening under a bridge that a piece of his skin was kept and stretched out to cover a book which was tucked into one of their grand libraries. Someone in that university must have a London man's sense of humour. My only regret in the whole affair was that I let Susanna Bird go. But if I had not, nothing would have played out quite so wonderfully, and I would have soon forgotten her. As it is, I can't get her out of my wrinkled, curious mind. But perhaps she'll come back across the marshes one day. After all, with Weems dead, she'll think the danger past, and that only human men are lurking in the darkness to squeeze their hands around her throat. But I can wait. When the time comes, I'll beam my light out so bright, so enticing, she'll be drawn towards it like a summer bug to a flame. And then, in her last moments, she will fear the Lantern Man.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
At the town of Glanford Brig, where the mud is green and stinks of the sea, men have crossed the River Ancham for long as there were souls in England. It's said the first boats made there was stitched, oak tree boards darned together with needle and thread. For oaks, it's a holy tree. When one grows a catkin beard like a wise old king, its flesh is supple enough to be sewn, boards tacked with goat willow thread, yet strong enough to keep out the wet. Not to mention the darker things that dwell below the waves, if they ever come knocking on the hull. For the longest time at Glanford, and those droves around it, Kettleby as was, Scorby Brooks, Rawby and Wrestle, all were at the mercy of the waters. Floods came in upon door sills, and marshes breathing in at winter, belly swolled like a maid with child. Then out they flowed come midsummer day, revealing earth richer than Croesus. Until the Dutchman came, through all those dark months the bogs spilled over. The stink of the fens rolled in on the wind, and the cold salt kisses of the water wives were wet on the lips of all at Glanford and for miles about. So, to get around, most went by on boats. Oak boats and elder, seeing kin and making trades, staying inland, though away from the ruins of Thornton Abbey, where the restless shade of Thomas de Grentham, 14th abbot and wizard as he was, speaks silent word of his lost black arts to this day, though dead many a hundred year. Such folk as dwelt at Ancham Vale were in times past known as car folk, and to please the waters, they kept to strange ways. For in the fens come winter, where mists rose up by night, thick enough to clutch your tongue, and lapwings peeped, the mud was yare enough to stand and reach to grasp a man and pull him under. Many knew it, saw pale and creepy fingers in the mire, which were called
dead hands, for that is what they were. To keep safe, all gave to the boggarts who held the fen waters at their command. Gifts to the dead hands of chicken eggs and fish, and bone things to the water wives, and to their husbands, those that some called green coaties and some called yarfkins, all manner of delights. Though the carfolk called them strangers, to most beyond Ancombe Vale, those men of the marsh were known as Tiddymen. This is for they grew no taller than a 3-year child, no higher than your knee. Though all had beards and great big hands and feet, and ugly heads rolling about on their shoulders, they walked limpety-lobbledy, mayhaps as they was lame, looking like deary wee grandfathers with long white hair and whiskers all cutted together and tangled. Most times the folk of Glanford kept well in with the Tiddymen, for if left alone those strangers harmed no one, and if people were good to them they never forgot it and helped them back. Come summer, it was said they wore grass-green jackets and breeches and yellow bonnets like toadstools atop their queer little faces, with long noses and wide mouths, their tongues hanging out and flapping about. They were mischievous and playful, folk said, and in the harvest fields they pulled the corn ears about and tumbled in the stubble. They wrestled with poppy heads, tweaked the flower buds and chased butterflies, tugging worms out of the earth in jest. In spring they fell to shaking and pinching the tree buds to make them come open, and if happy they helped the corn to ripen. The crickets played for them with a right good will, and they painted the pretty colours of the flowers and made the reds and browns of the fruit come autumn. It was well known if you'd only stand quite still out of doors, and you'd see the tiddy things running and playing all around you. They were never heard to speak, but if made angry, they grinned and yelped like angry dogs. But when gay, they'd come croodlesome and twitter and cheep as soft as birds, laughing like pie-wits, making the sound of ooey, ooey, ooey. Though that were only in the bright months, when they gave. In the cold times, they take and they take and take and take away, for that was when their bills came due. When the cold rains fell and Ancombe River ran quick out on towards the sea, and the fens grew fat and black and wet, by night the strangers danced on the glebe underneath the moon. Gowned in grey for winter time, they could scarce be seen through the thick mists, but came out from their water holes with the sound of running water and a sough of wind. And there were large, flat stones found here and there in the valley, where the waters never touched. The stranger stones, they were called. By days, people smeared those stones with blood and lit fires on them for the Tiddymen to dance about. For if they didn't, they were hell to pay. People did all they could to keep in with them. Laid on those stones the first flowers of the garden, first orchard fruit, first ears of harvest corn, a bit of bread and salt, a drop of milk or beer. And the givers went home quick once they'd laid down their gifts, paddles racing through the gloom, for none would want to see the tiddy folk eating at their victuals. And when the deepest dark came on, people walked about with lights in their hands and smeared the sills of windows and doors with blood to keep the horrors off. At Yule, priests would call such actions sin and heathen, but the carfolk did their part, made cakes of grain to roast beside the hearth, then left them on the stranger stones, bobbing out upon their boats to keep the Tiddymen sweet. When they were happy, you knew it, for they'd screech out like pie-wits, ooey, ooey, ooey. But when angered, oh, you knew that too. Things withered, Harvests failed, folk went missing or hungry, and the waters rose and rose right up to doors, sometimes pouring in. The mists turned green, and from out them came the tiddymun to take what should have been gave. Folk that did give had nought to fear, but those who shirked, who kept food back in hoards, the strangers knew and took their share with their tiny little hands. One year, just such a thing occurred to Balfour, preacher of Kettleby, back in the reign of Charles I. A proud man, Balfour thought to go without was good, so deprived himself and his daughter Kay to a larch thin from when she were a girl. Balfour saw this as sacrifice, but the tiddyman thought him a miser. More's a shame, for a good sort was Kate, pretty and fond of Gilbert Tyrwhitt, son of Sir Ralph, lord of the manor there. In the summer, young Gilbert came from Glanford upon his pony, and Kate would walk with him amongst the fields and orchards full of life. Balfour, who were priest, was in no place to offer up her hand to folk such as him, but still she'd come home with flowers in her hair and a glow on her rose-apple cheeks. Some said the money didn't matter, that Kate would wed Gilbert and become a fine lady, even though she were carfolk. In those sunny times, the tiddymun must have seen her out a-walking and taken a liking to Kate, greater than Gilbert Tyrwhitt. Back then, see, the duchies came. Sir Ralph had monies from the crown to drain the fens and make all Ancombe Vale good farming land. So the Dutchmen dug out dikes and drained the fens, and the greencoaties, well, they hated that. They spat and raved and wanted more and more from people laid upon their stones. And though Dutchmen disappeared, pulled beneath the mire, more were sent, and the work carried on, with Balfour blessing the duchies at their work. More though, Balfour, well, he never gave. He thought the strangers outside God, not knowing the Bible and born of Cain. So, one winter, with the waters up, the bog spilled into Balfour's home, and the strangers came and snatched young Kate, taking her away beneath the mud. Once Kate were took, Balfour aged right quick. His hair turned white and eyes pale blue, out staring like he saw a ghost. And Gilbert, of course, without his Kate to walk with and canoodle by the fire, he came no more to Kettleby from Glanford on his pony, and the girl was never spoke of, save for when folk whispered she was taken by the Yarthkins and eaten in the mist. In winter, no work was done by the duchies. They kept to their camps and spoke their foreign tongue, and if we speak the truth, the carfolk all despised them. Like oil and water, the fenfolk and the Dutch stayed well apart, and through the dark months when the tiddymun went hungry, all who knew their ways feared spring, while the duchies gave not a fig. Years passed in this way, and things got worse and worse. Cattle died, no crops would grow, and the green mists came, claiming old and young. But the king's gold were good, so the networks of dikes were dug summer after summer, though little did folk know that Kate, though took, were far from dead. Instead, she were beneath the earth, down deep below the still green water within the strangers' caves. To them, you see, Kate Balfour was much as like a jewel, bright and shimmering. Her white skin was as moonbeams, and she were a treasure to them. Not wicked and tantrumy like their water wives, she was a giant to them too. Tiddy as they were, they clambered up all on her, round her legs and in her hair, tying it in elf locks full of curses far too dangerous to lift. They knew not their strength, and hurt her with their graspings, their twistings and their pokes, but Her voice was pleasing to them, so she would sing them lullabies and make them calm. And she washed their tiddy clothes ready for spring and cooked the things the carfolk left upon the rocks, lighting little fires in their caves and living with the Yarskins down below. Within the dark and wet, away Kate's clothes did rot. She was never seen by men, so felt no shame, dressed up in muck and slime such as it clung upon her. Moss grew on throughout her hair, and tree roots curled about her here and there. In summer, she wished to go and walk beneath the sun to see Gilbert and her father too before he died. Yet the tiddyman kept her hid, so her eyes came all but blind in the dark. And where the tiddy hands and fingers touched her and moved her this way or that as pleased them, she lost her ways to care. And she never laughed, even when the strangers did, cheeping and twittering, ooh-wee, ooh-wee, ooh-wee. As time went by, of course, Sir Ralph saw to it that Gilbert wed, marrying a maid from Goole, and the duchies dug and dug, so the land grew dry and hard, but the Dutchman watched amazed as the carfolk went about the fields and offered water to the four corners, singing to the Yarskins. Tiddymun without a name, they sang, here's water for thee, take the spell undone. But it was of no matter, the tiddymun were bold as brass. Children withered and died, and food was scarce. Seeking help from God, the people stoned the wall-eyed witch from Gorby out of the marketplace and ducked Sally of Wadham in a pond until she nearly died. They said Our Father backwards and spat to the east to keep the Tod Lowry pranks off, but it was of no use. This was as, you see, the strangers would no longer give to them, but only take. Their water wives had drained away, and their dead hands turned to bitter sod from which no life would spring. Beside this, the tiddyman's powers were for naught good, or so it seemed. Until one day, a Dutchy captain named Egbert Bass did a cunning, cunning thing. See, through all the years, Egbert saw to Balfour's once. The priest came, ragged and half-starved, and blessed the men at work. So the duchies fed him meat and potatoes and fine things, hot and rich and holy in their way. And the priest prayed on over the Dutchman's work, so Egbert learned the old man's language, enough at least to understand the sadness in his heart. So he wished to help him, and when winter came once more, shivery-like, with skirls of bitter wind and water, Egbert waited out one night, hidden by a stranger stone, a long, dark musket on his back, a fire burning beside a pile of gist. Afore long, out came a tiddyman, gowned in grey. He was, the Dutchman saw, no bigger than a child of three, just like old Balfour said. He'd come up darkling with the mist, creeping, limpety-lobbledy, his long white beard and hair glinting in the fire's light. And Egbert watched as he gathered up the sausage meats and hams, dancing a leaping jig, laughing like a pie-wit. Ooh-wee, ooh-wee, ooh-wee. Though right amazed, Egbert did not take his musket up and shoot the stranger dead. Rather, he watched it moving off, back down into a waterhole. And then he blew a whistle, called his men, and that's where his team of Dutchies did start to dig. It took them time, of course, for the Yarskin caves ran deep, but on and on they worked through sun up and across the day, until all of a sudden there broke out the awfulest wailing and whimpering all about them. It was a sound like a lot of crying babies, sobbing as if their hearts would break. Like lost children, the tiddymen reached up with their little hands, cheeping with their cold lips, for the duchies had broken through into their deepest grotto. And there they saw, covered in the tiddy beasts, a thing most of the Dutchmen thought was their mother. A strange fiend they spied, not so unlike a pretty maid, clad in naught but mud and moss and roots. And as the winter sun fell upon her, she wept, for the brightness caused her pain, and she shrank from it in terror. Though the duchies sought to shoot her dead, Egbert Bass bade them not. Rather, he took out his sabre, shaking it and prodding till the tiddymun left off. Then up he scooped the Yarthkin mother, who was no more than Kate Balfour, and he dressed her in his jacket and carried her to Kettleby, to the house wherein her father lived. The commotion all about was great, for the Dutchmen lit fires then, burning down into the waterholes and blasting out the Yarthkins with black powder. The stranger stones, too, they broke down, striking them with hammer and pick till nought was left but gravel. Wild as this day was, wilder still were the faces of the people who saw Kate Balfour, as she was that day, come back from the dead, or so it seemed, tangled up in mud and roots, brought home by Egbert to Balfour's cottage. Alas for Kate, as when her father saw her, his pale heart gave out. Old as he was, he fell flat upon his back and died, so she never did see him alive again. But Egbert watched as she made her way about the place where she had grown, crawling on hands and knees. She touched over her father's form, then held and sniffed at all the items in the place, creeping into the corners of the cottage and weeping, for she'd returned, ever changed, to a half-forgotten land. For days, Egbert Bass stayed with her, sat near or just outside the door, and Kate washed herself clean in hot water he fetched her, but none of her old clothes fit, in spite of her father having kept them in a heavy trunk. So Egbert sent his men to Lincoln and brought her back linen and lace, thread and wool, and the folk of Kettleby gathered around in clumps, waiting and waiting until she reappeared. As she did, dressed in a new gown of her own making. Her sight was never good again, but she told the car folk of her time beneath the ground, living with the tiddymun. And Egbert listened too, in spite of all the fen dwellers making it clear they sought him gone. Few gave her tale much credence, but word reached Gilbert Tewit, and he rode by from Kettleby Hall, bearing witness to Kate Balfour as she was then, years older and stranger than ever she had been. It said Gilbert wept on seeing her, for she was so beautiful, but not for him. As for Kate, whose heart was broken long ago, the sight of Gilbert was of no great import. He was a fatter man than the boy she'd loved as a girl, and balding with bad teeth. Far more handsome was Egbert Bass, and when Gilbert rode away, it was the Dutchman who stayed behind, keeping at distance, asking her what more there was that he could do to please her. With her father buried, and the people of Glanford Brig, Kettleby, Scorby Brooks, and all about observing her with suspicion, like some strange being not of the earth, Kate thought at last of what she sought from Egbert Bass. This was, in time, to be his wife, and to travel with him far away to Holland, where life might begin for the pair of them anew. Egbert had loved on first sight the fair maiden hatched from out the fenland ground. So he of course agreed, and come spring, with the dykes finished, the pair set sail, never to be heard of in Lincolnshire again. As for Ancombe Vale, once the siege of Hull was won, the Tyrwhitt line ended and Kettleby Hall was torn down. Time ran by just like the river there. The earth grew lush and fruitful, the people less inclined to go about in boats. Still, for many years, on each new moon, the car folk still went out to the nearest dyke edge and teemed water in the foss, saying, "Tiddymun, without a name, here's water for thee." Who knows if this old prayer was answered? The land there is good to this day, so who's to know? But on a misty night, it's still said, you'll hear the tiddymun's cries, and sometimes see a fire for them, burning in the dark. Whether they dance about them as they once did, though, well, you'll have to ask a braver soul than I.
God send every gentleman such hounds, such hawks, and such leman with a down, derry, 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 down, down.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.